Okay, Nick, you have the stage.
Good evening, everybody. This is Nick here. I'm the creator of Haze Reviews, and I'm very honored to be kicking off tonight's discussion, our call about Chapter 8, which is Tragedy and Hope, Chapter 8, International Socialism and the Soviet Challenge. So the plan is to go for the next hour, hour and a half, to have a bit of a discussion about the contents of this chapter. We've been doing this on a month-by-month basis, working our way through this epic, huge doorstop of a book, which is so detailed and so dense with information and knowledge that we've got to really take our time to chew through it. But the previous calls have been very edifying and interesting. And so tonight I hope we can have a similar level of conversation. And just up front, I want to say this is not all about me sitting here delivering a lecture. I'm very keen for people to participate. So if you want to chime in or ask a question or add a comment or interject with something I may get wrong or I may have missed, then please feel free to do so. And I'll try and leave some space in between my ramblings for people to do that. All right. As I said, this is Chapter 8, International Socialism and the Soviet Challenge. This chapter's really a key part in history that I think is overlooked and more people should be aware of, because rightly so, as with many people who claim to be modern day Nazis or neo-Nazis, you know, if you're waving a swastika flag, it looks really bad and people will immediately call you out and maybe arrest you and really look upon you with a lot of suspicion and a lot of distaste. But that is not so for the same to be said for the emblems and the icons of communism and socialism, despite the fact that, as we learn in this chapter, that ideology and those systems were responsible for the deaths of millions and millions of people. It's still okay in the modern day to call yourself a communist and to call yourself a socialist. And I think ignorance of this part of history is kind of what makes that possible for a lot of people. So this is why, for me, this chapter was incredibly instructive and very valuable to read and learn from. And I've made some notes, and I've done lots of sort of penciling, underlining, and highlighting in my copy of Tragedy and Hope. But just for people following along or reading along, I'll just tell you that my copy, the copy I'm using, is the fairly recent republication of the book. And this chapter that we're looking at today, Chapter 8, starts on page 375. I know there may be discrepancies between the versions that you might be following along with, but that's where it is in my book. So when I say page numbers, if I'm talking about quotes, please bear that in mind. It might be at a different page in your book. This chapter, it's divided up into three parts. And the first part is the International Socialist Movement. The second part covers the Bolshevik Revolution to 1924. And then the final part covers Stalinism, 1924 to 1939. I'm going to talk a little bit first about the International Socialist Movement and what I got out of this chapter. Quigley gives us an introduction, first and foremost, as to what drove and went into the rise of socialism. And he gives us a list. He says that it happened in reaction against some things and in support of some things. And he says that it was a product of, and the things that stood out to me were humanitarianism, scientific materialism, and democracy. The three of these that really stood out to me is scientific materialism, because this was really crucial for the horrors which followed to take place. It had to be built on scientific materialism, because scientific materialism kind of removes concepts which religion or spirituality might take into account, things such as the soul, things such as free will, things such as spirit. These things are sort of removed in a scientific materialistic worldview, and it allows for the sort of dehumanization of human beings and for them to be treated in really horrific and terrible ways, because after all, they're just animals like any other animal. They're just bundles and bags of biological chemical reactions, and why do we have to treat them any differently than we would any other bag of chemical reactions, right? So scientific materialism, that's a really key part of the worldview that allowed all this stuff to go ahead. And then the other thing that stood out about this explanation of socialism that Quigley gives us is he says there were almost as many different kinds of socialism as there were socialists. So that tells us that this is a worldview and a movement based on relativism, where the individual person gets to decide what is socialism. And there's no real defined, concrete, agreed upon definition of what it is and what it looks like in practice, right? And this allows for all manner of chaos and pain and suffering to take place. Relativism, where you get to decide what is right and what is wrong, it means we all have our own individual truth, and my truth is my truth and your truth is your truth. But this means there's nothing to unite us all. There's no shared understanding of reality, how things work, which opens the door to all sorts of horrific things to happen, which come later in the chapter. So Quigley tells us that industrialism was one of the things that fed into socialism, right? Because the conditions of industrialism, which led to the formation of these huge cities, were sordid and unsanitary. Quigley even says that in many cases, persons were reduced to conditions of animality, which shock the imagination. So this links us back to the scientific materialism, the point that I made about that earlier. People were living in these horrific conditions, and then others were looking around going, this is terrible, this shouldn't be happening, this is obviously an affront and needs to be stopped and changed. And so socialism rears up to say it's going to fix these things, it's going to improve these conditions, and to an extent, it did. After industrialism and the poor conditions there, Quigley gives us a little sort of overview of how this thinking and the ideas developed. And he talks about a split in 1848. So in 1848, there was pre-1848, there were the utopian socialists. And then post-1848, there was scientific socialism. And what's so important about 1848? Well, that was the publication of the Communist Manifesto by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. Now, what I thought was quite interesting is Quigley doesn't go into the backers and the funders and the promoters of Marx and Engels. He doesn't really tell us that they were exiled, that they were living in London, and that they were receiving a lot of financial support from a variety of people, a lot of American Wall Street industrialists. That aspect of the story is either left out on purpose or he didn't know about it, but that's covered in the works of other people. Anthony Sutton is probably the best example in his book, The Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. So I just found it interesting that was omitted here or he didn't know about it. But after 1848, we had the scientific socialism. So this is folded into this idea that with science, we can fix all the problems. We don't need anything other than the scientific method and a group of scientific elite who can look at the data, look at the information we have and make the decisions and apportion what is the right amount of products and services to go to different people depending on their needs, right? So science is a very key component as well of what happened. But then I think due to this point Quigley makes of socialism being very relative, he talks about divisions within the movement. So he tells us about after 1848, he says the basic division within the socialist movement after 1848 was between those who wished to abolish or reduce the functions of the state and those who wished to increase these functions by giving economic activities to the state. So this is a division between anarcho-syndicalists and then the socialists on the other side. So the anarcho-syndicalists, they were looking at things and saying, do you know what? Humans, men are innately good, but that is corrupted and distorted by coercive power. And the source of this coercive power is the state. So it's very interesting to me. I didn't realize that early socialist thinking included this anarchist thinking, this pointing at the state and its monopoly on violence as a source of evil and degradation to the human soul and the human spirit and the basic cooperative, generous, kind nature of the human species, right? I didn't know that was wrapped up in the history of socialism. That was quite a revelation to me. But the anarchists, they come up with a solution, which is to destroy the state. And the way they're going to do that is to assassinate the head of the state. And so this led to a bunch of assassinations. But, you know, the state is kind of like a hydra. You chop off one head and five more heads appear in its place. So it was pretty poor strategic thinking on their part. But nevertheless, they gave it a crack, and that included killing a king of Italy and also a president of the United States between 1895 and 1905. So then syndicalism, the other part of this, anarcho-syndicalism, this was the idea that, okay, well, instead of being coerced to do things by the state, let's all organize ourselves along lines that are voluntary. Let's consent to the ways we organize and form these labor unions and these syndicates as a way to not need the coercive powers of the state, right? So anarcho-syndicalism, that was one faction within the early socialist movement. And then we learned that the other faction was the second group. So it says here, this is page 377 now, the paragraph at the bottom. It says, the second group wished to widen the power and scope of governments by giving them a dominant role in economic life. So I think looking at the state of the world that we're in now, we can have a very good idea about which of these two groups came out on top in this particular division of thinking, right? But the second group, they were like, no, the state needs more power, more control over everything, more oversight, and more ability to manipulate things that we do and dictate what is done in order to best bring about a socialist system. So this second group, the statists, let's call them, it is this second group, this group of statists, which then split and became the communists and the socialists. This is according to Quigley. And Quigley defines the strict interpreters of Karl Marx are the ones that come to be known as communists, while the more moderate revisionist group come to be known as socialists. That's page 377 to 378. So that's Quigley's sort of definition there, where he splits and he explains what is a communist versus what is a socialist. This is really interesting to me because I'd learned recently that classically and going back and historically, communism and socialism have been treated as basically either the same thing. In the case of Marx, he used the words interchangeably. Or in the case of Lenin, he said that socialism was the transitory stage between capitalism as it becomes communism. I hope that explanation made sense. So I'd been thinking and learning about this recently. And so it's very interesting to know that these words that are so familiar to us, we might think we know what they mean, but sometimes we've got to actually look up these definitions and make sure we're very clear on what we're talking about. This is a good way to make sure misunderstandings and arguments down the pub don't get out of hand. You know, define your terms and get clear on what it is you're talking about, because one person's socialism, as Quigley tells us, could be completely different to another person's socialism. But we end up with these two groups, the communists, the literal diehard Marxians, they're the communists, and then the socialists, they have a less aggressive approach, they're not as revolutionary, and they're more interested in reformism. All right. And they are more interested in, okay, let's work with what we've got and transform it over the long term. So that's kind of differentiation according to Quigley and his eyes. So moving on page 378, there was another really critical concept that Quigley describes that I think we hear a lot about. And this is what he calls the historical dialectic, but what many people may be more familiar with the label, the Hegelian dialectic. And I was quite surprised to see this in Quigley's book, because I've heard about it so many times, you know, all these talking heads who float around and get amplified in the alternative news world, or the alternative, or the truther community, or whatever you want to call, you know, this realm of cyberspace that we inhabit. They talk about this Hegelian dialectic all the time. So I was quite surprised to see a mainstream historian, Professor Carol Quigley, explaining it to us here. But he explains it because he says it's one of the three concepts that goes into Marx's theory and worldview and his ideas, right? So the historical dialectic, or the Hegelian dialectic, if you want to call it that, this is a theory, and I'm quoting now from Quigley, this theory maintained that all historical events were the result of a struggle between opposing forces, which ultimately merged to create a situation which was different from either. Any existing organization of society or of ideas, this is the thesis, will call forth in time an opposition, which is the antithesis. These two struggle with each other and give rise to the events of history, until finally the two fuse into a new organization, the synthesis. So you might have heard this before, thesis, antithesis, or antithesis, and then finally synthesis. Another way this is sometimes expressed is a problem, reaction, solution. That's another favorite phrase that gets thrown around and often repeated. So this kind of validates this methodology in a way that Quigley's mentioning it, talking about it, so that it underpins the idea that when we're talking about these kind of ideas to people who might be in disbelief or might say there is no, none of this sort of thing going on, we can really point to Quigley and say, no, it's a real thing. It does happen. There it is. And it's part of Marxian doctrine and ideology. So the reason this popped out to me, not only because I was surprised to see it here in an academic book of this size and rigorous study, but also is because what occurred to me is that if you manage the thesis and the antithesis steps in this process, then you get to create the outcome, the synthesis that you may desire. And when I'm saying you here, I'm talking about the kind of high-level manipulators and of society and the social engineers and the hidden persuaders, as they might be called by Vance Packard. If you are aware of the thesis as it is, and you can foment and fund the antithesis, the uprising, the revolutionary spirit, right? Then you can steer things towards a synthesis of your own choosing and your own desire. And I think, that's kind of what we are, that idea I just described is, I think from my understanding and other books I've read and people I've listened to, I think that's largely what happened with the whole socialist communist movement. Although Quigley doesn't really give us that angle on things, not here in this book anyway. But to go back to his explanation of Marxism, he talks about three concepts that build up Marx's theory, which is the historical dialectic, which we just discussed, economic determinism, and the labor theory of value. And these three things allowed him to come up with a complicated theory of past and future history, and his view that all history is simply the history of class struggles. That's all it is, right? And so he comes up with this idea of history, which is free men versus slaves. And then it became patricians versus plebs. And then it became lords versus serfs. And now, in the present time, or Marx's time, it was the bourgeoisie versus the proletariat. And so he picked out this pattern, and he cast it, looked at history through this lens, and that is what informed his writings and his thinking on this whole sort of matter. So after we have this overview of Marxian, I think that's the right word, Marxian thinking, we learn about some of these other phrases that are probably quite familiar to many people. One of them is the dictatorship of the proletariat, which Marx predicted would eventually arise. And I kind of think this is a strange phrase. The dictatorship of the proletariat. Dictatorship to me is one. It's one man. There's one dictator or woman or whatever. There's one singular individual at the head of that, steering it, dictating to everybody else. So it seems strange that you would have the dictatorship of the proletariat, where the proletariat is obviously a group. But then I was thinking, isn't that kind of what we have, in that we have a system whereby the majority get to say what they want and then it is granted? 51% of the people who go and make their intentions and their preferences known, they get their wishes granted, and then the 49% have to put up with it and deal with it. So in a sense, this idea of the dictatorship of the proletariat, I was thinking, yeah, that's kind of what we have, right? And what Quigley says on page 380 is that this dictatorship of the proletariat would lead to the political, social, military, intellectual, and religious aspects of society all being transformed into a socialist fashion. So again, I was thinking, does this describe where we're at? Are we living in an era where these institutions and areas of society that I just listed have all been sort of infected with a kind of collectivist or communitarian type of ethos and way of doing things and way of operating? You know, just questions that are kind of popping up as I'm going through this. So, moving on. Quigley covers the first, the second, and the third international. So remember, this chapter is international socialism, and it was an international movement, or maybe still is, but I think they've changed their branding these days. But it was an international movement. And so on page 380, he tells us the first international, this was, we already covered this bit, actually. This was the sort of anarcho-syndicalists versus the statists, right? The second international was then formed by the socialists. Quigley tells us this group retained its allegiance to Marxist theory for a considerable period, but even from the beginning, socialist actions did not follow Marxist theory. So at this point, we're seeing that Marxist theory is actually lacking in many, many respects. And in fact, the predictions of Marx turn out to be in some ways the kind of direct opposite of what actually happens. And we see this further down the page, right at the bottom. It says, quote, "The picture which Marx had drawn of more and more numerous workers reduced to lower and lower standards of living by fewer and fewer exploitative capitalists proved to be completely erroneous in the more advanced industrial countries in the 20th century." So Marx, he really got it wrong. His ideas and his theories were way off the mark when it came to how societies and people, human beings and economies actually work. So this is another thing that I find surprising as to why there are still people out there who call themselves communists and socialists when their systems caused so much suffering in practice, when they were tried, when their key figures and their thinking and their writings are so obviously disproven by reality. It just blows my mind that there's still people out there who who kind of call themselves by these labels, right? But one of the key things that Quigley, that I got out of Quigley's description moving on was the bit about how, to go back to the reason why Marx's thinking was lacking, Quigley says, "The real essence of industrialism was to be found in the application of non-human energy, such as that from coal, oil, or water power, to production. Mass production could only exist if it were followed by mass consumption and rising standards of living. Moreover, it must lead in the long run to a decreasing demand for hand labor and an increasing demand for highly trained technicians who are managers rather than laborers." So this bit stood out to me because in my work and the books that I read and talk to people about, I'm often using this phrase, the managerial elite. And I think that's really key and a concept that's very closely tied into international socialism as a movement and as an ideology, because it always requires this elite small group of managers, quote unquote, who know better and are scientifically advanced and intellectually superior to the rest of us to administer and oversee this bloated, complicated bureaucracy, which is just sort of self-serving and grows kind of like a cancerous tumor on our society. So I just wrote in the margin there sort of managerial elite. And when you are frustrated by the bureaucracy that you have to deal with in your day-to-day life, then this chapter and the study of international socialism helps understand why that system is the way it is and gives you a narrative that kind of makes sense of why all this hoop jumping and form filling and permit seeking is necessary. Well, it isn't, but they just tell us that it is, right? So that was Karl Marx. He was way off the mark, pun intended, with his thinking and his predictions. All right. So let's move on a little bit. I'll pause there to see if anybody has any quotes or wants to interject with something. I will have a sip of water because my mouth's a little bit dry.
Nick, you're doing great. This is Melissa. And I just wanted to say there, Quigley doesn't get into who is funding Karl Marx when he was living in London and writing, primarily doing all of this writing in London. and the reasons why people might have wanted to fund him. And I don't have a huge background on that. I do know that he, just like Lenin, he was promoted by the West, just like this was funded. He too was. It would just be interesting to know, since he was so far off the mark, was this just a intellectual starting point for a big revolution? You know, the whole idea of Marxian thinking. Just a question I don't have the answer to.
Yeah, thank you, Melissa. And I think that's a key part of it. This, and as we mentioned with the Hegelian dialectic, the revolutionary part kind of comes into that second bit, the antithesis, doesn't it? To have this continuous ongoing revolution so that you can justify raising the systems to the ground and bringing in the next iteration of it, the next mm-hmm. system of control with the increased, more finely tuned mechanisms of surveillance and mind control and behavior modification. And so I think revolution, you know, the clues, the word of, think of a wheel just going round and round and round and round and never stopping, right?
That, I was just going to mention then it, the, I like thinking things in quite simple terms, not always, but like, the right and left, you know, as we look at these paradigms in our political, most people look at it as a line, left and right. So right's got normally less government. They want less government and they're conservative. And then the left want more government and they're liberal, meaning they sort of want change. So it, like, I'm sure, a lot of people feel like, well, I do anyway. I was sort of more to the left, maybe center, but now the political line sphere has changed and I don't feel like I've changed, but I'm more to the right. So it must be the political sphere that's changing. So that right could be, you know, a conservative thesis. And then the left, the antithesis, wanting to change. And then most people don't want to be on these extremes and, you know, they're in the center, the synthesis, so they can sort of guide these posts how they need.
Yeah, thank you, Greg. I think you're absolutely on the money there. That reminds me of another concept, the Overton window. And this is, if people are not familiar with it, this is the idea. The Overton window is what is socially acceptable to think and say and believe. And within that Overton window, there are the left and the right, let's say. And anything outside that Overton window tends to freak people out because they've been conditioned through mass media, through the television, through their education or their schooling, as I prefer to say it. They've been conditioned to view with disdain and suspicion and horror anyone who is outside that Overton window. But the Hegelian dialectic allows for that gradual, slow changing through the revolutions, through the repetitions, the cycles of crisis and then calm, panic and then relaxation. It's this continuous, like, 5 steps forward, 3 steps backwards, but you're still slowly marching in the direction that they want you to go, even though you think you're voting for Labour this time or you're voting for the Conservative Party this time. You're actually getting the same thing and being pushed and nudged and guided in the direction that they want you to go in. And that's a really key part.
Nick, could I add a piece?
Yes, please.
Am I coming through all right?
Loud and clear for me.
Oh, great. When I look at and read up on odd Marxist theory, and I look at the time period that it was written in, and then I look at what's come our way politically. To me, Marx is a Trojan horse for democracy, because you don't want democracy. Democracy is the demos kratos. It's the control of the mob by a small governing few. So you have socialism for us, and you have ownership and profiteering for the few. And if you look at what Marxism is, you can cloud democracy in all kinds of terms, like capitalism or whatever it is, but all the isms are thinly veiled disguises for, it's always the case where a few manage the many. And I think that we are living in a Marxist system under democracy. I was just thinking of a Leonard Cohen song, and it said, democracy is coming to the USA. People think, well, haven't we already got democracy? The United States is being brought down into a socialist system, and what is America's greatest export, or claims to be its greatest export, is that it's spreading democracy around the world, and that we have to safeguard our democracy. But the United States is not supposed to be a democracy. It's supposed to be a republic. I think if you take another look at Marxist theory, I think if you read between the lines, it's democracy. What do they all want at the end of the day? What did Eric Blair write? You know, the end goal, the dominant social political system that they want for a world federal system is social democracy. I was just thinking along those lines.
If I can just come in with her a little bit. Thanks for what everybody's been saying. Good presentation, Hayes Reviews. But I was thinking that when they talk about what you're saying, Darren, with it being like Marxism under the disguise of democracy and things like that, well, in a lot of the new Marxist theory, they talk about how the proletariat has turned into the happy consumer. And the consumer isn't just like goods like Nike shoes or whatever, but it's entertainment. And that's you go to your work, you get enough money to buy stuff, and you're sitting watching the sports and all that entertainment. And so they call it like that you're seduced in this society, to be this Marxist kind of society, you're seduced to become a happy consumer. And that's just my little point that you triggered in my mind there. And that the new Marxist theories go that say that this, that Marxist theory is still actually quite relevant. And that that's why you've got, for example, feminist Marxism, different kinds of Marxism as they still promote it. And I think it's still quite alive, actually, in these different ways, and it expresses itself in our societies. And I live in Norway, and it's quite socialistic, and there's been big changes in certain ways, but it's been interesting to kind of witness it too. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Fiona and Darren as well. Really, really great contributions there. And I agree with your points wholeheartedly. Darren, that's kind of the point I was trying to make with this idea of the dictatorship of the proletariat, that yeah, that is democracy and that is what we've got, right? And Fiona as well, I think your points are really on the mark with how indoctrinated with this consumer way of living we have become. And part of the way that this socialistic system with its overbearing nanny state bureaucratic instrumentation that we are embedded within, part of the way that that exists and goes unchallenged is because we've been de-skilled and defanged and dumbed down by those very systems. And so we're simultaneously told, well, you need these systems to provide all these services and provide all these things that you can't do for yourself. We're told that while we're also being conditioned to not be able to provide these things for ourselves. So that's kind of the vicious circle and the trap that we're many of us are in, and sort of seems to be unfolding on a mass scale. And you can see it generation after generation, the next generation being slightly less capable and knowledgeable about very basic things like how to, you know, sew a button on a shirt or how to grow herbs in a plant pot or something. Certainly as technology is more and more invasive in our lives, and now the advent of these so-called AI programs and ChatGPT and whatnot, we're going to become even further de-skilled and divorced from our innate abilities as human beings to think clearly and to have compassion and empathy for other people and want to help them. We are actually being sort of brutalized in the sense of being brought closer and closer to the level of brutes in the sense of livestock and domesticated animals such as sheep and goats and cows and this sort of thing.
You know, Nick, I think I'm correct in saying this. In one of Alan's talks, Alan mentioned the fact that we're handed down the culture. So we're, in point of fact, consumers of culture. And people, most people would be kind of unaware of the fact that this is actually a product that is being pushed down to them from on high.
And it's one of the biggest products. I hate to leave this really excellent presentation and discussion. I had an hour or basically 55 minutes and I have to start something else right now. And so my regrets for leaving, but carry on. And I look forward to hearing this when it's all done and then putting up the video.
Thanks, Melissa. I hope your next appointment is equally engaging and interesting.
I hope so too, because it better be. I'm leaving a very excellent conversation and you all have fun and learn a lot.
Thanks very much, Melissa, and a particular thanks for your last real news with that chap John, I think was his name. Oh, great, great stuff.
Well, I'm actually doing a part two with him right now in 5 minutes and for next week, and this was his only window, so I'm going to take it. But I'll see you all soon.
Fantastic.
Thanks, Melissa.
Bye, Melissa.
Can't wait for that.
Yeah, good stuff. Good luck, Melissa. Hayes Reeves, I'd like to get back, make two comments. One, I want to get back to the why this happened, who was funding Marx. Why was he in London? Who was funding him? But before that, you talked about modern communists or modern socialists and their hopes for this to prevail. Why do they keep pushing for this as it's failed time and time again with countless millions of people dying in its attempt to rise, right? And the common answer you hear is, well, they didn't do it right, right? We have the playbook, but no one really did it right. And that answer just drives me nuts because it's a never ending scheme, right? Like, as long as we can say they didn't implement right, we could keep trying and trying again. There's no end game. So I just want to throw that out there. And the second part is Marx in England. Who was funding him? You guys mentioned that a couple times and we kind of glanced over it. So I did a lecture on Victorian architecture. I'm from San Francisco, so that's very kind of prominent. And our homes and housing. And so I did this lecture on Victorian kind of fashion and architecture. And during my studies into this, it really took me into the social aspect and the occult. It really turned less into what, you know, why these, it really took me into the history of what was going on at the time. So, right around the time Marx was in London was this transition from the Victorian age to the Edwardian age. And what does that mean? So this is really the transition from the old ways and into the new ways. What does that mean? That's traditionalism to progressivism. That's conservatism to liberalism. This is when Marx was in London. There was a huge shift, you know, Industrial Revolution 1 to 2. All these families, like, of the time who were middle class entered this upper class category. These were not old elites. These were not old royal families. Yes, they were definitely very present, but a bunch of new families rose to prominence because of businesses they owned. And during this time, this transition was a bunch of rich, spoiled kids with nothing better to do than to challenge their parents in a really unproven, unsighted testimony here. That's really what happened. It was the kids acting against their parents. This is the rise of, like, huge alcoholism and drugs into high society. This is where in the next 10 years, all these secret societies started rising in England. This is when all the young kids and their new wives were getting addicted to all kinds of booze, laudanum, opiates, and then occultism is risen in. So they're no longer supporting their own old religions and old norms. They want to form their new society. Later on, we hear of the Golden Dawn and OTO, Yorkish rites. These were all rising very prominent at that time. And so it makes a ton of sense with all these kids with the all this newfound money that want to try something new, want to learn something new, would find people like Karl Marx, stand them up, fund them, because they're yearning for ideas. They're yearning for something new. They want to take their parents' legacy and make it their own. We see this later with the Fabians, and now we see it today with all the, again, 150 years later, with all this new money from high tech, it's happening again. So anyway, I just wanted to take a stab at that thought of why was Marx in London, who was funding him, and why. I can't give you any names, but that was kind of what was going on at the time.
That's a really good point. Thank you for coming off mute and sharing that with us. And yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the Fabians, because I recently did a reading of The Fabian Freeway, which is a 1966 book by Rose Martin, and we read through that thing in its entirety. And as soon as you said sort of bored children rebelling against the ways of their parents, my mind went to that book, to the origin story of the Fabian Society, because that is exactly it. They were from, well, upper middle class families. Their parents and their money came from industry, from business, from capitalism, and they were bored, and they'd been indoctrinated with the Darwinian macroevolution scientific materialist worldview, and they'd flirted with a few other things, theosophy and vegetarianism. This is what it said in the book. And eventually they decided to, right, let's latch onto this revolutionary thing that we see going on across other parts of the world, and let's bring that here over to England, and eventually spread it over to America as well. So that's a really key part of the history and the continuity of this movement and this way of thinking, which you just really did a good job of summarizing there. Thank you.
And I'd like to add one thing, because, you know, I had it in my mind to say it, just like you mentioned, theosophy, that was a driving force. Feminism, this is the time when it moved from the male god entity into a push for the sacred feminine. All these things are happening at once, and to lump in, like from a Marxist perspective, to lump in all oppression to a man, the rich elite man, well, the answer is the woman. The mother will care for you. This is all happening at the same time. So thanks for bringing those up.
Could I just add something here, Nick? There was a mention there earlier on of the left and the right, and a wondering why this kind of failed experiment is attempted again and again and again. My simple triple short on this is that it is simply the left and the right dialectic in action. And the powers that shouldn't be are never going to let this go, because it has to keep happening, one bouncing against the other. And there I mentioned there of a whole lot of other aspects of kind of fragmentation and breakdown of systems. The phoenix can't rise unless the old system is completely flattened. And I think that that's what has been in process now for decades. It's the long march, you know, the slow plod forward. And I think we found in Fabian Freeway, if I'm correct here, that the original emblem of the Fabians was the turtle. But then they decided to change that at some juncture to a wolf in sheep's clothing. And to me, that sort of signaled, well, okay, now they're off to the races. This thing is being accelerated.
Yeah, well said, Frank, definitely. And I think actually the remainder of chapter 8, the next two sections, kind of give us a view as to what may be in store and what may be the outcome of all this upheaval and change and the bloating of bureaucracy. So to take it back to the book, the next part in this chapter is the Bolshevik Revolution to 1924. And this section and the one following it, which is about Stalinism, goes on to talk about how this small group of Bolshevik agitators came to take over this absolutely huge nation, right? The size of it. I mean, I'm here in England. We're quite a small nation. We had our empire back in the day, but we're still quite a small little island. And to think of the size of some of these other huge countries, you know, it's kind of hard. I know that I can drive and be at the beach in an hour, pretty much wherever I am in the country. And to think of these huge land masses just teeming with life and people spread out, living off the land, it's hard to wrap my head around, right? But this small group, the Bolsheviks, they did manage to take control and take power. And this account that Quigley gives us of how this happened was quite fascinating, because, and I'm on page, let's see, 386 now. Quigley tells us the Bolshevik group under Lenin's leadership put on a powerful propaganda campaign. He says they had constant agitation which served to neutralize or alienate support for the provisional government. And this was especially true among soldiers of the two chief cities. And so on November the 7th, 1917, the Bolshevik group seized the centers of government in St. Petersburg and was able to hold them because of the refusal of the local military contingents to support the provisional government. So this is showing you the power of propaganda, right? They'd waged this propaganda campaign and they'd got the soldiers and the military and the order followers, you know, the heavies, the brutes, the bullies, to lose their allegiance. And in this way, they were able to get in there and seize control. But as Quigley goes on to tell us, the problem was they didn't really have a plan for what they were going to do, right? So further down the page, 386, it says, to the Bolsheviks, it seemed to be quite clear that they must simply try to survive on a day-to-day basis, hope to keep the great mass of Russians neutralized by the achievement of peace, bread, and land, and trust that the rapid advent of a socialist revolution in industrially advanced Germany would provide Russia with an economic and political ally which could remedy the weaknesses and backwardness of Russia itself. So one of the problems that the Socialist International had is that they all agreed that in order for socialist revolution to take place and for communism to be established, you needed a nation to be fully industrialized, because this is part of their mythos, part of the Marxian mythos, is that the issue is that the bourgeoisie own all the tools and the factories and things, and they're exploiting the workers who all they have is their labor to exchange. Okay. When they got into power, I just totally derailed myself. I forgot where I was going with that point there. So they got in. They didn't have a plan for what they were going to do once they were in power. And so what happened after this was extreme economic and social collapse. This is page 387. There was an almost complete lack of products such as clothing, shoes, and agricultural tools. By 1920, industrial production in general was about 13% of the 1913 figure. And at the same time, paper money was printed so freely that prices rose rapidly and the ruble became almost worthless. Again, echoing and paralleling the times that we are running through with the prices of things changing, with the money printing machine going brrr, this hyperinflationary scenario doesn't seem that hard to imagine. We might be facing that in some parts of these developed Western countries, you know, at a sooner than we would like to think. And Quigley tells us that due to this chaos, because of their lack of planning and ability to handle all of this organization, the loss of life in these 2 years of famine reached 5 million. So 5 million, that is just an impossible number of people and an impossible amount of pain and suffering to wrap your head around. But Quigley continues, in the course of this chaos and tragedy, the Bolshevik regime was able to survive, to crush counter-revolutionary movements, and to eliminate foreign interventionalists. They did this while being vigorous, decisive, and completely ruthless. They used a secret police called the Cheka which was made up of fanatical and ruthless communists who systematically murdered all real or potential opponents. There's a good section just below that, page 387 to 388, describing the Red Army and how much ruthless murder and torture and pain had to be enacted in order for power to be maintained by this small group. So continuing on, what Quigley tells us is that in order for this to continue going, who suffered and who needed to be exploited? Well, of course, it was the Russian peasantry. And they were the main people who suffered under what was called war communism, whereby all agricultural crops were considered to be government property. All private trade and commerce were forbidden. The banks were nationalized. All industrial plants over 5 workers and all craft enterprises over 10 workers were nationalized. This system of extreme communism was far from being a success, and peasant opposition steadily increased in spite of the severe punishments inflicted for violations of the regulations. This culminated in peasant uprisings, urban riots, and a mutiny of the sailors at Kronstadt. Within a week, a turning point was passed. The whole system of war communism and of peasant requisitioning was abandoned in favor of a new economic policy. So this is something that I read about actually first on Wikipedia when I was researching for the Fabian Freeway series that we did. When this was happening, the only way they could solve it, and Quigley backs this up and says it here on page 389, the only way they could get out of this predicament was free commercial activity in agricultural and other commodities, with the reestablishment of the profit motive and of private ownership in small industries and in small landholding. Requisitioning was replaced by a system of moderate taxation, and this resulted in a dramatic increase in economic prosperity and in political stability. So right there in the history of international socialism, as exemplified by the Bolshevik Revolution, is contained the dangers, the horrific outcome of trying to put a system such as that in place, and the only way to get out of it, which again is a profit motive, private ownership, and small to medium-sized industries who are allowed to own land. So I thought that was quite telling and a very key part of the puzzle to remind people who go around in the present day calling themselves communists and socialists. I'll pause there for a second and just have a sip because my mouth's a little bit dry. Does anybody want to jump in?
Nick, I just wanted to add the point that you made with democracy. I think you might still be getting to this part in the book where when the communists set up their government with their various bureaucracies, agricultural bureaucracy, what they had, their different divisions. I think there were 5 main divisions. I can't remember the name now. But what they gave the people, you know, you had the Communist Party at the head of the whole lot. But in all these different state departments or bureaucracies, they gave people the vote. They were given candidates to vote for in each of these divisions. So one party, but there's still democracy. The people still had a choice, in a sense. So if you look at how the whole Marxist philosophy got going, it came out of the West. The main agitators for what happened in Russia was nurtured in London, in Germany. The philosophy made its way through trained people like Lenin, who went into Russia and got the whole ball rolling. And if you take a look at Russia, that massive landmass, how do you standardize an entire massive continent like that, including China? Because China went through the same thing as the Russians. You have to install the system and get the ball rolling. If you go back in the timeline to where Quigley, I think it was from the 1920s, Quigley defined from 1920 onwards as the technocratic the technocratic system of governance. So really it looks like when socialism split into communism was just fast tracking a less developed area, the less developed areas of Russia, China, and Southeast Asia, to get them up to speed with the West. So socialism is collectivism via the vote, and communism is collectivism via the boot, that communism will revert to a social democracy at some point, which I think modern-day Russia might be there now.
Isn't it true, Darren, that the Duma is just a toothless talking shop, or was?
I think so.
Yeah, that's excellent points there, and very fantastic analysis of the bigger picture view. And I think it reminded me of this expansion and eventual envelopment of the whole world that is baked into these kind of collectivist ideas, because it's sort of predicated on this getting bigger and bigger and bigger and taking in more resources and gaining more control and conning people into thinking that's a good thing because, hey, you get to vote, right? You've got a vote. You can put an X in a box. Don't you feel good about that? We're going to listen to you. And by this mechanism of putting an X in a box, the X marks the spot. You are being listened to and you're steering the ship. It's your responsibility. And the outcome can therefore be put on the people who vote.
Yeah, Nick, the vote is such a con, because if you have a decent constitution and a republic that's based on, you know, the rights of the individual, a balance of the individual with the collective, you don't need to have a government that's divided into a left and right wing. It doesn't make any sense. All you need is a very small state apparatus to uphold the basic functioning of contract, law of contract, and just law in general, and defense. The rest just takes care of itself if you leave people alone. So if you want to really steer a large group of people, you have to split them down the middle and give them two different representative parties. So you divide them and you get representatives to represent each divide, and then you can frog march people any which way you want. So it's mob rule, or rather ruling the mobs. In Russia, they just did it through one party in a very hurried, forceful way to, I suppose, the goal is to standardize the world. So Russia was so far behind, China was so backward as well, that these enormous areas of human existence had to be brought into alignment with the West. But really, it's at the very higher levels, it's one global system that are controlling the East and the West. As soon as they start looking very much identical to each other, then they'll switch to another gear, I suppose, and call it something else.
Yeah, right on. And to back up those points you were just making, I've got the perfect quote from the book in front of me, which is page 390. And he's talking about this Bolshevik system, the system, you, as you mentioned, Darren, that was hastily put in place. Quigley says, "This system had certain notable characteristics. There was no separation of powers, so that the various organs of government could engage in legislative, executive, administrative, and, if necessary, judicial activities. Second, there was no constitution or constitutional law in the sense of a body of rules above or outside the government, since constitutional laws were made by the same process and had the same weight as other laws. And third, and here's the kicker, third, there were no guaranteed rights or liberties of individuals, since the accepted theory was that rights and obligations arise from and in the state rather than outside or separate from the state. Last, there were no democratic or parliamentary elements because of the monopoly of political power by the Communist Party." So I just wanted to throw that in there as well, and because it really backs up what the point you were just making about there was no constitution, there was no recognition of anything above and beyond that state apparatus. The state is God, the state is dad, the state is mom. But the craziness of it is the state's just made up of people, right? And there's a little more description of how this is a kind of flaw in the explanation of what we are told as the way it works, right? On page 391, Quigley writes, "At the top was the Central Party Congress and the Central Executive Committee chosen by it. As years went by, the Central Party Congress met more and more rarely and then merely approved the activities and resolutions of the Central Executive Committee. This committee and its parallel institution in the state, which was the Council of People's Commissars, were dominated until 1922 by the personality of Lenin. His eloquence, intellectual agility, and capacity for ruthless decision and practical improvisation gave him the paramount position in both party and state. What he's saying there is, like, even though we are told everyone has a vote and everybody is equal, it still boils down to a small group or one guy being totally in control and having the final say, in the same way that a monarchy and a royal family, the king is the main one. But the only problem is in this system, one of the problems is that, as I mentioned before, the blame can be now shifted out to everybody who voted and never laid at the feet of, in this example, Lenin, or the one figurehead who is sitting at the center of the web. And this is one of the sort of insidious mechanisms of a communitarian or a communist or a socialist kind of effort, is that you can never hold individuals or groups of individuals accountable because, well, you all voted for it and this is a group effort and this is what the nation and the society and the community wanted. And so how do you, when things go bad, how do you make sure they don't go bad again? How do you get justice or prevent the perpetrators from doing it again? It's much, much harder in this kind of system.
Two things, Nick. Firstly, Lenin was considered so dangerous that when he was transiting across Europe to Russia to foment the revolution or to kick it off, he was only allowed to do so in a sea.
Did everybody else lose Frank there, or was it just me?
Whoops, yeah, sorry. I lost them too.
Sorry about that. I think I'm back. What I was saying there was that Lenin was considered so dangerous when he was transiting across Europe to Russia to kick off the revolution, the Germans would only allow him passage through Germany on a sealed train. That was the first thing. Second thing is, somebody was concerned earlier on about how the revolution was financed. Where did the money come from? My understanding is that it largely came from the Wall Street banks.
It was really great what you'd said back there, Nick. And this is true, Frank, that with Lenin, it was dangerous. But I don't want to, I think we couldn't go through this talk today without just mentioning Animal Farm and George Orwell, because he did a really, really good job of that with Lenin and Stalin and these characters and the pigs in the book. And CM, when people have said to you, oh, communism would only work if they'd followed Marx and did it properly and stuff like that. But actually, in the book Animal Farm, it kind of shows you how power corrupts and how, you know, all pigs are equal, but some are more equal than others, etc. It's a really good illustration of why communism goes wrong, really, because power corrupts and things. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. I think I haven't read this book. I'm Bookworm invited me, so I'll get caught up at some point. But that message conveyed that it's the perfect system to install a veiled totalitarianism. And when I say veiled, is the totalitarian is hidden or protected from accountability. But at the end of the day, that's what it is, right? It is the ultimate elite class. And, you know, so thanks for sharing that. That's where my mind went with it.
All right. Thank you both. Yeah, really appreciate that, those contributions. And Animal Farm is an excellent thing to mention, because we get that short form condensed allegory for this system and what ends up happening. But the other thing is just looking at history itself and being aware of it and seeing that the way, the road down which this kind of thinking took people. But I think, Animal Farm is I haven't even read that. I shouldn't admit that on here, should I, publicly? Don't hold it against me, everybody.
You got to read it then.
Definitely. I'll keep my eye out for a copy when I'm book hunting. So the third part of the chapter, which we can touch upon quickly, is all about Stalinism and the absolute insanity that went on once he sort of succeeded Lenin and became in control, right? And so we're on page 392 now in the book. Stalinism starts about halfway down the page and quickly tells us that this new economic policy, which we talked about as the way which the Bolsheviks got out of that hideous famine condition, this new economic policy performed successfully, and the Soviet Union experienced a phenomenal recovery from the war communism that preceded it. And this was done by re-establishing a new monetary system based on gold. So again, they saved themselves by reintroducing the things that socialism, communism is purportedly dead against, right? They reinstituted small and medium-sized ownership, and they reinstituted a gold-backed currency, so they weren't just printing worthless fiat money out of nothing. So, and then at the very bottom of the page was quite a choice quote that I enjoyed a lot. It says, Quigley writes, "A regime of freedom was permitted." Imagine that you are permitted to be free. Well, I'm sorry, but if I need your permission, it's hardly freedom, is it? Right. So I just found that turn of phrase quite entertaining, and it did give me a little chuckle. Continuing on, Quigley gives us an account of the creation of two class of people. One is the kulaks, and one is the nepmen. And this was because industry and trade was not under such rigorous tight control anymore, and there was a currency backed by gold, which allowed things to restart and for the economic recovery to take place. And we get a few stats on page 395. Acreage under cultivation rose from 148 million in 1921 up to 222 million in 1927. Production of cotton quadrupled, and coal production doubled in 3 years. And so the Russian economic system in 1927 got back to where it was in 1913. So this took 14 years of intense hardship and struggle, starvation, pain and suffering. But they recovered it, and they recovered it by instituting the things that they said they were up against, they were against and they wanted to get rid of, right? Then Quigley tells us about what's described as the scissors crisis, which meant that the goods farmers sold were at low prices while the goods they bought were at high prices. So this was to do with a mixed industrial system, which was then brought in. And this caused a lot of problems as well, which they had to deal with by kind of instituting more communism. But one of the phrases that I didn't know about that I learned from Quigley reading this chapter is this phrase, socialism in a single country. And what Quigley tells us is one of the disagreements that Stalin had with Lenin was that Lenin wanted to go for the worldwide communist system, take it global. He wanted to take it global. One of them wanted socialism in a single country, and the other one wanted to take it all over the world. If anyone can remember exactly which one was which, just please pipe in and tell me so we can get that on the record and get it correct. But basically, Stalinism and his group, when they were in control, they were aiming for going after socialism in a single country, because it was realized that without the help of other countries simultaneously instituting a communist type system, that Russia would not be able to do it on its own due to its being underdeveloped and not very largely industrialized. And so Stalin and his men, they decided to take things in a new direction. And Quigley gives us three factors of what describe this new direction they wanted to take it in at the bottom of page 394. The three factors which constituted Stalinism were: one, the bloodthirsty and paranoid ambitions of Stalin and his associates; two, a return of Russia to its older traditions, but on a new level and new intensity; and three, a theory of social, political, and economic developments, which is included under the phrase socialism in a single country. So I think it was Stalin who was going for the socialism in a single country concept. So what this meant was, and as we mentioned earlier, they all knew that communism couldn't be achieved in a country that hadn't been fully industrialized. And so Stalin decided to make this full industrialization a priority. Quigley tells us that there was only two ways to do this, right? Russia, which was so far from being industrialized, could obtain the necessary capital only by borrowing it abroad or by accumulating it from its own people. In either case, it would be taken in the long run from Russia's peasants by political duress, in the one case being exported to pay for foreign loans, and in the other case being given as food and raw materials to the industrial workers in the city. So once again, it comes back to this, it falls onto the peasants to be exploited and to provide the labor and the energy and the life force to make this happen, right? What happened after this, as they tried to roll this out after war communism, Quigley tells us on page 396, the first step towards the industrialization of Russia required that the peasantry be broken by terror and reorganized from a capitalistic basis of private farms to a socialistic system of collective farms. Moreover, to prevent imperialist capitalistic countries from taking advantage of the inevitable unrest this program would create in Russia, it was necessary to crush all kinds of foreign espionage, resistance to the Bolshevik state, independent thought, or public discontent. So you can imagine, and I'm sure people on the call may be very familiar with, the Gulag Archipelago, the famous book by Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who was in the Gulags, and the conditions that existed therein. At this point in time, people just threw out truth and everyone became suspicious of each other. And there was this horrific, paranoid atmosphere in the air as people were being abused and lied to and manipulated and tortured. But there was really no recourse whatsoever, right? So it sounds like a truly horrific time to have been alive. Quigley goes on to tell us about the 5-year plans, of which there were three. He says that due to the Russian records lacking and being hard to get hold of and maybe even not existing, we only have a good idea of the first 5-year plan. And this first 5-year plan was their plan to collectivize agriculture. So to carry out the plan that I just described in that last quote. Quigley tells us that in this first 5 years, the communal farms had crops which were owned jointly by the members and were divided. Oh, sorry. This is before the first 5-year plan. The communal farms had crops that were owned jointly by the members and were divided after certain amounts had been set aside for taxes, purchases, and other payments, which directed food to the cities. In the state farms, the crops were owned outright by the state after the necessary costs had been paid. In time, experience showed that the costs of the state farms were so high and their operations so inefficient that they were hardly worthwhile, although they continued to be created. So more top-down control and disenfranchising the peasants and the native population, you know, of the things that they own and they produce. So a total disconnect here. You don't own anything, even though you made it and you looked after it and you tended to it and you grew it. You don't own it. We're taking it from you and we're sending it over to the cities and the people in the factories who are working hard on building machinery and weaponry and these sorts of things as well, right? Quigley then gives us an insight into what happened to the people who resisted this. He tells us on page 398, all peasants who resisted were treated with violence. Their property was confiscated. They were beaten or sent into exile in remote areas. Many were killed. And this process was known as the liquidation of the kulaks. This affected 5 million families. Rather than give up their animals to the collective farms, many peasants killed them. And as a result, the number of cattle was reduced from 30.7 million in 1928 to 19.6 million in 1933. And then there's more statistics there about the sheer, just unimaginable numbers of animals that were killed, not to mention the humans, the families that were affected by this. So just the word liquidation is so horrifying to me that it's used and it's labeled as this, and Quigley uses it in inverted commas. So I don't know where this quote originally comes from or who coined that phrase. but it certainly sends shivers down the spine to think about. Then there's another, a bit further down on the same page, quickly tells us that Stalin told Winston Churchill that 12 million peasants died in this reorganization of agriculture. So remember, this is still in the first of the five-year plans. 12 million peasants, and that's Stalin telling the figures, right? So just unimaginable levels of suffering and struggle and hardship, but it's all for the good of the cause. Okay, comrade? I'll just pause there. Does anybody want to interject or have a comment on that last bit we just read?
Nick, I just wanted to bring up something that made me want to reach through the pages of the book and hit quickly on the head with a lead pipe, because he describes the incredible psychopathy, the top-down terrorizing and torture of the peasants, you know, and the unbelievable suffering, the unbelievable, even amongst the elite, they couldn't relax either, you know. But the part that got me, and I'm paraphrasing because I haven't got the book in front of me, I'm sitting in the dark here, but maybe you can see it there. It's toward the end where Quigley says, well, even if they didn't put in a system of communism in, this probably would have happened in Russia anyway, because the Russians, they are just like that. That's just the way that Russians are. That's their sort of traditional way, which is the biggest load of nonsense on the planet. Look at what Stalin, Lenin, and his boys had to do to get people to do that to each other. It was not the traditional Russian way. Communism is a top-down, psychopathic, anti-human system, which you have to impose on people through terror and force. He describes all the suffering and then says that the Russians would have done it to themselves anyway. That was something that really stood out for me. So if I could reach through time with a lead pipe and hit quickly on the head with it, I would.
Nice one, Darren. Exactly. And the I've got that quote right in front of me, and so I'll read it through now, because I had exactly the same reaction, and I couldn't believe what I was reading when I got to this part. So we'll just get that on the record so that people who maybe haven't read the book or who are just listening can experience that as well. Not that it's a pleasant experience, and I think lead pipe is certainly going easy on the man. But yeah, so he says on page 404, which you know, that's kind of could be symbolic in and of itself. But this is page 404, and he says, it would be a grave mistake to believe that the Soviet system of government, with its peculiar amalgam of censorship, mass propaganda, and ruthless terror, was an invention of Stalin and his friends. It would be equally erroneous to believe that this system is a creation of Bolshevism. The truth is that it is a part of the Russian way of life and has a tradition going back through Tsarism to Byzantianism, and to Caesarism. In Russia itself, it has typical precedents in Ivan the Terrible, Peter the Great, Paul the First, or Alexander the Third. The chief changes were that the system, through the advance of technology, of weapons, of communications, and of transportation, became more pervasive, more constant, more violent, and more irrational. So that's the quote there. Yeah, just an incredible assertion to make. And you've got to question the motives and the reasons why he would put that point in there. And I think I'll just hand it over to Frank, because I think you came off mute and you wanted to say something.
Sorry, Nick. Yes, I did. I just simply wanted to comment there that that was Quigley's Putin bad moment.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then the other thing where he does something similar, just to go back a few pages, and I was explaining the liquidation of the kulaks. He says on 399, he talks about, in spite of all these problems with the expansion of the agriculture and the collectivization of the agriculture, without ever becoming successful or even adequate, the Soviet agriculture provided a steadily expanding base for the growth of Soviet industry until both were disrupted by the invasion of Hitler's hordes in the first summer of 1941. And then he goes on to describe this as an impressive physical accomplishment. And so it's very strange to read the words of somebody who isn't speaking out in strong emotive terms about such intense and unspeakable and unimaginable horror and suffering. I suppose that's just Quigley's role as a historian, and he tries to keep a certain detachment from the things he's describing, so that he's not making it emotional and he's being a little more clinical about it. But I think it's quite strange nevertheless, and it says quite a lot about the sort of mindset of the author himself, and probably the kind of strata of society from which he came and who he represents. So I think we're pretty much coming up to the full time for the call now. I would be very happy to open the floor and see if anybody has any sort of closing comments or observations or wrap up conclusive things to say.
Just want to make a comment. I think the current situation we are in is they are moving towards communitarianism, talking all about communism and capitalism and socialism. It's actually all leading towards communitarianism, which is a centralized governance of private industries as well as the public government, where we have things like, for example, Twitter, which is kind of like the conscience of free speech, taking over from the government and from common law. Yeah, I just want to mention the role of communitarianism, which is kind of like the new communism, so to speak. If anyone has any comments, we'd be glad to hear.
The first time I heard that word communitarianism was from the book Rosa, Behind the Green Mask, and I can never think of the name correctly, so I would have to ask Frank. Rosa Quare or Quar?
Yes, Nick. Rosa Quare was the lady's name.
Rosa Quare. Thank you. I remember you helping me with that a previous time when I tried to pronounce it. But her book, Behind a Green Mask, explains exactly this and how communitarianism is being baked into the way our local councils are run. So knowing how your local councils are run and getting involved in that is a very critical thing, and more important than looking at the national level and what's going on the national stage, because this has already been rolled out and established at that local level. And so that's a really key thing to know, and I think worth pointing out off the back of you mentioning that communitarianism.
The whole thing is moved from global to local. That's why you're correct, Nick. It's the local councils people need to be focused on.
All right. Other comments?
Yeah. I just wanted to say thank you very much, Nick. You've covered it beautifully, and you brought in the other aspects of socialism from the other material that we've been following on Hayes Reviews, and it came together very, very nicely. So thank you very much.
Thank you. You're very welcome. And I think if I would have one, not a criticism, but an observation about this chapter is the name is, he calls it international socialism, but he really only speaks about Russia, and he didn't tell us about the Fabian Society and their legacy and their influence. And he was writing this, when did this come out? 1966. So he was probably writing it in the, I don't know, 5, 10, 20 years leading up to that. The Fabian Society, they became active from 1884, and they're totally not mentioned. So in a chapter about international socialism, it's quite curious how he doesn't really talk much about the mechanisms by which it was starting to spread and infect other places and other countries. So he's quite hyper-focused on this one area of the world and what happened there, which is very useful for us. But at the same time, is he leaving things out deliberately? Is he, has he been instructed? Because we know he was an establishment man. He was a mainstream guy. He was acting for the CFR and very close to the strata of power. Was he told to leave certain things out? That would be my sort of final question.
Can I offer an answer to that?
Please.
If you take a look at from the start of Quigley's works, you know, he's very, very pro-West. He's an Anglophile, and he puts the West on a pedestal. Everything about the West is honorable. It's respectful of the individual, and, you know, he completely glosses over the essentially the feudalism and the communism and the essentially old Europe went through communism, really, just in different words. And then he compares the East and the Russian ethos and the way that they exist. You know, at that time when Quigley wrote the book, you had the Cold War. You had the East versus the West, and Quigley was a Georgetown University professor who basically, you got to remember who he was instructing and who he was educating. And he was educating the young classes of people who would study and then go out into the world to implement the Western global hegemony.
Bill Clinton was a notable student of his.
Yes, so they had to, they couldn't give the game away. They had to create within the mindset of these people that there is the East and they are the ideological enemy. So it probably suited Quigley to downplay and not mention the Fabian Society. Even though Clinton was a member, we know that Quigley would have been fully, fully behind and probably a Fabian himself. So there's a reason why he doesn't bring it up. And that's probably because at that time, in the 60s, in that period of time, it was very much the Cold War. There was that dichotomy. So the people that he was educating at the lower levels, it's important that they believe it. You know, you can't get people to enthusiastically support you if they know that it's just a game, or if they know it's a manipulation. So I think, you know, there are circles within circles, and Quigley's students would have been propagandized by him and his crowd to be the, you know, the active busy bees in the furtherance of the greater dialectical between the East and the West. So now we get to a point where you have the Russia-Ukraine proxy situation going on there with the United States. That's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out, because there has to be some kind of a synthesis that comes out of the Russia-Ukraine-American thing. Somebody has to come out as the ideological winner, and somebody has to come out of it as the ideological loser. Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see how it unfolds, but I think that might answer your question as to why Quigley doesn't mention the Fabians.
That was an excellent answer. Thank you so much, Darren. And I think I really concur with everything you just laid out there. It makes perfect sense to me from other reading and other things that I know. And yeah, thank you. I really appreciate that.
I lost my way there towards the end, but anyway. If you just bear in mind that they are, you see, when people are learning about the way the world works and they're waking up to how it does work, they tend to think that everyone is in on the secret and they are now learning about it. And they think that there's just one grand secret which eventually everyone knows all the details about. And then it takes time for them to realize that it's a need-to-know basis. Now, you have a structure of circles within circles, and you have a degreed system of confidence. So Bill Clinton, for example, you know, where would he have stood in regards to knowing the full plan? You know, it's pretty much a certainty that he had an idea, but he wouldn't have known the full details of it. Even Churchill, you know, Alan mentioned the situation where Churchill bitched and moaned because he complained in Parliament that he was being kept out of the loop, and yet he was Britain's war leader, you know, and he wasn't made aware of various aspects of the functioning of the war. When you factor in that there are circles within circles, and the people that we are presented with as being sort of like the big players, like Stalin, Churchill, Roosevelt, just remember that they are the political face which us little, tiny little plebs at the bottom look up and see and think, as we're supposed to look up to the likes of these people and think that they represent the pinnacle of power. It's not even close. So you realize there's huge is a huge management team and bureaucracy and degrees of knowledge that go over and beyond the politicians that we think are calling all the shots. Then you will break out of this. People will break away from that phase of thinking where they look at a Putin and they look at his personality and they think, ah, he's just a dictator and he's a bully. And then they point at Biden and they make comments about Biden, or they talk about, you know, and the media loves nothing more than to get us, or to get the people engrossed in the cult of personality. And, you know, it just gives, it reinforces the public that a Biden, a Putin, you know, actually have the power that they appear to have. Meanwhile, it's not true at all. Yeah, I think I've said enough. Thanks, Nick.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. All right. So I think let's bring it on home then. Excellent concluding comments and observations there. And so let's wrap it up. I want to say thanks to everybody who's participated and been here, whether you're listening in, whether you're coming off mute and contributing to the discussion. It's all valuable and it's all such a worthwhile project and a great thing to be doing in this era full of digital information, short-termism when it comes to learning, our attention spans being bombarded with crises and all sorts of stuff going on. It's really nice that we can come together and take some time out to read a book and chew over what we are learning. And I think it's a really worthwhile endeavor. So I just want to say thanks again for the opportunity to sort of facilitate this discussion today. And I'm looking forward very much to the next installment and all the ones that are to come in the future. So enjoy the rest of your weekend. Thank you very much. Talk to you all soon.
Thank you very much, Nick, Andrea,
thank you, Nick.
And Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Sail on, sail on. shores of Lee, past the reefs of green, through the swamps of heat. Sail on, sail on, sail on. America first, the cradle of the best of the worst. It's here they got the range and the machinery for change, and it's here they got the spiritual thirst. It's here the family's broken, and it's here the lonely say that the heart has got to open in a fundamental way. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Democracy is coming to the USA.